the gavel as the convener here to begin the operation. And, well, Greg, why don't you introduce the staff, first of all, then we know, and then we'll just tell us who everybody is and who you are.
Mr. Chair, I'm Greg Kupincher. I work with the Legislative Coordinating Commission, and our office provides administrative support to a number of councils and commissions, including this one. Casey Gerkovich is on the side doing our tech for getting our recording devices going, and Sally Olson is also our commission administrator.
Good. Well, and my experience from last time around was the staff was absolutely excellent and really helped a great deal and made life for commission members a whole lot easier and better. So, well, I think in my job, as I understand it, as a convener, is to get us convened, and then we'll go around and have some introductions, and then follow the agenda items here, unless somebody has some other approach to what they wish to make. So I would suggest that we just start in then with introducing ourselves and tell a little bit about yourself. I think that's one thing, so we kind of get to know each other a little bit. I think would be a good idea to get started. Want to start over here?
Start with me?
Sure.
Sure, okay. Good morning. My name is David Asp. I am a lawyer at Lockridge Grindall Nowen in Minneapolis. Appointed by the Chief Justice, and I had the pleasure of serving on this commission 2 years ago. I'm looking forward to doing it again.
Good. Peter?
Good morning. My name is Pete Gregory. I live in South Minneapolis with my wife and four boys. I work in Minneapolis as an attorney, and I also was an appointee of Justice Gilday. And this is my first time serving in this committee.
I'm Mary Lynn Dahlquist, and I'm a public health nurse. I live in Cambridge. And I also, I was appointed by the governor, and I was on this council 2 years ago as well. I'm looking forward to meeting everybody again.
My name's Tom Evenson. I'm a litigation attorney at Lynn Jensen, Sullivan & Peterson in downtown Minneapolis. I live in Maple Grove, and I was on this council 2 years ago as well.
I'm Tom Berg. I was appointed by the Chief Justice. And was on the and chaired the council last time around in 2017, which is my first time on the council.
Good morning. My name is James Wensler. I'm an 18-year professional of human resources and appointed by the governor. And I'm serving from the Winona area of the state. It's been an honor to be appointed to the first time to this committee, and I've gotten to know Sally. She's been very helpful in giving instructions, so I did have to write my parking code on my hand, so I remembered it to type it into the machine. But it was one of those things where I really appreciate serving with everyone, and it's been a pleasure being here and meeting everyone. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Joy DeMarais-Lanz. I'm from Andover, and I run a small association management company based here with an office out of Indianapolis. And I was appointed by the governor.
Bob Meyerson, Candiota County, appointed by the Chief Justice. I'm a banker. But this is a second career. I'm a failed academic in European intellectual history. And if you say history repeats itself, I'll go over there and make your eyeballs pop out of your head.
God, you're scary.
In agreement?
In disagreement.
You might want to move down.
Yeah, you're
blocking. I'm Jim Fox. I served on the 2017 council. I was appointed at that time by the governor. I don't know who appointed me this time, but here I am again. I've been a compensation consultant mostly to government for the last 35 years, so bring a lot of that experience to this committee.
I'm Jennifer Zlinski. I live in South Minneapolis, and I work for Molina Health as a clinic specialist, business services side of healthcare. And I was appointed by Chief Justice Gilday, and this is my first time here, so very excited.
I'm Gail Olson. I'm a retired attorney, formerly general counsel for the State Colleges and University System, and a former deputy attorney general. This is my second time, and I was appointed by Chief Justice Gilday. And I live in Lake Elmo.
And Gail, because of some of your background and the compensation, why don't you expand a little bit about that?
About
Gail was one who knew something about this whole compensation scheme and how it worked here in Minnesota. That was quite helpful last time around. I thought it was.
Well, I think I'm familiar with much of state government, not everything in state government, but much of it. And so I've been able to see how compensation works in the different agencies and different branches of government and public offices. I'm familiar with data practices, but the expert's over there. So we'll hear from her, I guess, later.
Good. Thank you.
I'm Jim Robbins. I'm on for the second time as well, since 17, appointed both times for Congressional District 4 by the Chief Justice. I represent the Small Cities Association and do some communications work for them as well. I've also lived in Western Carver County and Northfield, have a journalism background, but St. Paul native.
Mr. Chair? Yeah. Members, we received word this morning from Annie Deckert, an appointee of the Supreme Court, that she had a death in her family last night and will be unable to be here today.
Other than that, we have a full complement?
We have a full complement, Mr. Chair. There are... let's see, I think we have three absent members at the moment. Sally?
Four.
I should mention I'm going to have to leave early for a legislative hearing in Mankato, so I'll have to sneak out in about an hour.
Well, one thing I learned last year was that we had to always take recorded votes, and I would sometimes kind of get going sort of fast and forget about that and have to be reminded, but it is a little different dealing with the Data Practices Act and certain rules we have to follow and so on and so forth, right?
Members, we need to take recorded votes when a member is participating, when one or more members are participating by phone. If we're all here physically, we don't need to do that unless someone calls for that.
So, well, the first item then, unless there's any other, anybody wants to change the agenda, the first item is to elect a chair and a vice chair and entertain nominations, discussions. I'm a believer that we're a small enough group and know each other a bit now that I try to keep a meeting pretty informal and just chat a bit. So what would you like to do?
I would like to nominate Tom Berg as chair. I think it's very important to have political experience, and last time we met, you reined us in at times, and I thought that was good.
Second.
Okay, well, thank you for that. I should mention, I didn't mention, I had served, before most of you were born, 8 years in the state legislature back in the 70s here, and was the United States Attorney for Minnesota, so I have experience that we had kind of an interesting time. We had a couple legislators, the chair of the Finance Committee that came in, Lynn Carlson, who I served with. He's the longest serving member. Lynn is still here. On that. So I had that background. But I know I think others may have some interest. Jim, are you interested in that? And if so, I think it's very appropriate for you to talk about. I have no strong feelings one way or another. Whatever the council wants to do is fine with me. Why don't you go ahead?
Well, I appreciate Bob and Gail putting your support behind you. I'm from the Winona area. I'm a human resources professional for 18 years. I've chaired committees and boards before in the past, and I do respect that there is some experience that the convener has, but if there's an option where you're looking for a fresh face and an opportunity for all of us to have an equal opportunity to have a casual environment, have an open and honest discussion where everybody is treated the same and equally, I'd like an opportunity to also serve as chair. I respect and look forward to the will of the committee, and thank you very much.
Other discussion, comments? I don't know quite how we go about the vote. Do we put our heads down on our desks here and the people, Jim, or how you feel
public,
about it?
Right? But,
whatever the council wishes to do.
Would Jim Wensler be agreeable to serving as the vice chair?
I would, because then it's a good learning process.
Then I'll nominate you for vice chair.
Second.
Well, let's take them one at a time. We don't want a slate here, I don't think. But let's, so we have one nomination, then myself, I guess, for chair. Any others?
Did you want to nominate yourself, Jim?
Well, I received the nomination from Bob. He was very kind to do that.
And there was as vice chair.
Yeah. I know, but I think we're on the chair right now. Right. Did you want to nominate yourself for chair?
I do not.
Okay, then we have a vote on the nomination of yours truly as the chair, which I'm willing to serve again if the committee wishes. If not, I'm more than happy to have someone else do it, too. But all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carried unless we have to do a roll call vote. Okay. We don't need. Okay. All right. The parliamentarian here, he's good at it. Why, I don't know, but we don't. All right. Then any other discussion now about a vice chair position? Do you go by James or Jim?
Jim, please.
Okay. Jim Wensler has been nominated. Any other discussion or other nominations? Now's the time to, again, just casually throw it out. Yes?
I just want to ask, and when we did this 2 years ago, my feeling to have a chair and a vice chair was because we are evenly split political parties, and I'm hoping we're balanced, but I don't even know because I haven't paid that much attention, but I'm just curious to know if we are politically balanced. And we know Tom is a longtime DFLer. Do you mind disclosing?
I am a conservative.
Okay. So that's good. We want that balance. So. Thank you.
Okay. Any other discussion? That was a good point, I mean, because it is important. And I honestly, to this day, I'm not quite sure where the political parties are of the members here, which I think is kind of cool. and I think it's a legitimate thing of why our recommendation hopefully can have some significant weight. Any further discussion? If not, all in favor of Jim as the vice chair, Jim Wensler, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion carried. Congratulations. We got some work to do here. All right. Then we'll turn it over to our staff people for administrative matters. And I guess, Sally, you're first up on the agenda.
I am. So I'm just going to quickly go over. Most of you are familiar. You're eligible for per diem and expense reimbursement for these meetings. In your packets is a form. Please try and, if you can, complete them so Chairberg can sign off on it at the end of the meeting so we can get it processed and get you reimbursed. And then there's also a little guidance on how to fill it out. And also, if anyone had trouble with the parking code this morning, just include parking on this form. And that's all I have. Other than that, I would just also point out that these meetings are all recorded and the audio will be posted to the Compensation Council's website. So just keep that in mind.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question.
Yes.
Sally, I forgot, I don't recall. Are meals also reimbursable for members?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yep.
That's it on administrative matters. We'll go to the open meeting law. There we are. Okay. You're so far away.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you so much for having me here today. I'm Lori Barkopensky. I am the Director of Community Services at the Department of Administration. I like to say that I have some of the coolest, best parts of admin. I have the data practices office, the state demographer, the state archaeologist, which many of you might not know we have a state archaeologist. Admin is mostly known for the services like taking care of your buildings, building your buildings, and taking care of cars and a variety of other things. One of the most important things that admin is going to be doing, with I think help from everyone, is serving as a liaison to the U.S. Census Bureau as we prepare for our 2020 census. So I wanted to make sure to put a plug in for the census. Today, since the majority of you are existing members, and I assume because you're appointed to this, you're probably really good volunteers who might already have experience with being on public bodies at your local government level or at the state level or school boards. So you may already have some experience with both the open meeting law and data practices. So this is going to be probably the fastest drive-by on these two laws you've ever seen. And know that with both Greg and Sally and Gail, you have a lot of experience in the room that you will, they will help you as you go through this. And feel free, when I get going, and I've already had some coffee today, feel free to stop me as you have questions. So the Data Practices Office is the statewide resource for data practices and open meeting laws. The bulk of what the office does is provide informal advice and technical assistance to government, groups like yours, the public, the media, and the legislature about these laws. These laws are known to be pretty complex, so we have a variety of resources on our website and newsletters that help people learn about this when they need it. The Commissioner of Admin also has the ability to issue non-binding opinions in this area, which is sometimes very helpful to citizens and government alike. We do trainings like these, as well as, little known, we help people do legislative drafting and assistance. Since these laws are complex, we want to make sure that any laws that are written really work within the existing framework of state and federal law. We don't often have policy positions on these areas, but we help make sure your bill does what you want it to do. So we're going to jump into data practices first. I think it is all, you know, the work that this council is going to do is very important, and I think the role that data practices and open meeting law play for our democracy cannot be, you know, undervalued. It is about advancing open government, government accountability, and transparency. We want our citizens to trust government and to be able to know and understand the decisions that government is making on their behalf. Our law presumes, which is kind of unique, we do not have a freedom of information model. Our law is based on everything is public unless there's a state or federal law that makes it not. So often that's why our law is longer and more complex. The power rests in the legislature to decide what data is going to be not public, instead of at the federal level where government agencies are given lots of discretion about how much data can go out the door. So we are much more open than I think than other or entities. But one of the things with that presumption of data being public, your email correspondence, Gail, if she emails Greg about the work of this council, is likely all public. So just being aware that this law is meant to have transparency. So that means that when you do the work of this council, no matter where and when, it really is subject to a data request and that it is likely public data.
Mr. Chair, members, for those who are straining to see the fine print, we have copies of the PowerPoint in your packets.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Greg. Yes, I meant to point that out as well. Okay. So, as I mentioned, the Data Practices Act presumes that everything is public. We've got a definition for government data that I'll talk about. It provides rights both for citizens as well as data subjects. So when data is about you, your driving record at public safety, my personnel file at admin, there are laws that detail who gets how much. And one thing is important to note is that the legislature and the judicial branch are not subject to the Data Practices Act. They each have their own laws around access. So this applies to state and local governments, so cities, counties, school boards, city councils, state agencies. There are two kind of partner laws as you think of data practices. One is the Official Records Act, which really requires entities to really kind of document what they're working on. Know that Greg and Sally are going to make sure that the documentation required for your activities is going to be taken care of. The Records Management Statute says is the vehicle that lets government know kind of how long and when can they start to get rid of those official records. So all these laws kind of work together to help make data practices as efficient as it can be. So government data, it is everything. Everything that you write down, everything that is recorded related to this government work is going to be government data. The only thing that isn't going to be government data is the mental impressions you have in your head about this work, about where you're leaning. That's the only stuff really that is not government data. So if it's a post-it note that says, I'm in favor of $300,000 a year per person. That posted likely is public data, and that would be government data as well. One of the things that often is off-putting about data practices is this is a chart that details the classification of data. We've got data that's public, and that means anyone can have it for any reason. Example is, you know, my name. I'm a Department of Admin employee. My name and where I work is public data. As I mentioned, there's also private data, where it's data about you that it's not accessible to the whole world. It's accessible to you, or if you're the guardian for someone and others, people inside the government who need it for their work. Our law requires that if private data is going to be accessed by another government entity, that the law says that that sharing is allowed. An example of that would be Social Security numbers. And then confidential and protected non-public are those, even though it's about me, so if there's an investigation at St. Paul PD about me and my business, even though it's about me, I don't get to see that data. But again, people inside that organization who need it can have it to do their work, and then entities who are allowed by law. So St. Paul PD could share data with Minneapolis about the investigation they've got going on about my business. So one of the next things on your agenda is to look through adopting some policies. Our law requires that there be a responsible authority. We just call it the RA. And the RA is the person who is responsible for making sure you comply with the Data Practices Act. So I'm not sure who you had last time. Greg, he's volunteering again.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Unanimous support for Greg. And then also, you have to have a data practices compliance official, and it is completely fine for Greg to serve in both roles. And that is really the person who handles the day-to-day of data practices. My commissioner, often we have a data practices compliance official who handles the day-to-day, and our commissioner is our responsible authority. So it was the legislature's way of saying, we really want someone who can, kind of do that hands-on work. And as I mentioned, there are two required policies, one for public members and one for data subjects, and that you will then adopt. And that explains to people how they would make requests to you and to whom they would direct their requests. So this is why you should care, or at least hopefully, the data about you. So some of the data about each of you is, in serving on this council, is public as well as private. So some of the examples of data about each of you that's public is your name, your residential address, an email address or phone, and your education, training, and background. So as Sally mentioned, some of you have already kind of described some of your background, and to the extent that Greg also has some of your background, that would be public data about each of you. I mentioned this a little bit when I was talking. So our law is really flexible. It doesn't matter if you are making your notes here today or at home on your personal computer or your phone or your own piece of paper. Government data is really when it is about the work that you're doing for this council. So it doesn't matter where or when or what device you're using. It's still subject to a data request if it's about the work of this council. So if Sally is making a list to what she needs to buy at Target, that might not be, that wouldn't be related to the work of this council. But if you were taking notes about this work, it would be. All right, so that was the fast on data practices, and now we're going to move into the open meeting law as well. I forgot to mention, how many of you have had open meeting law or data practices training before? You want to just raise your hands. Ooh, look at this. Yay! And you didn't run screaming from the room, which is always a very good sign. So our open meeting law, unlike data practices, which is, a long law and it keeps on getting longer, the open meeting law is relatively short, and a variety of it is in case law. It really talks about what groups are subject to this law and what meetings are subject. And it is primarily a notice statute. And it talks about closed meetings, as well as I'm going to talk about some special considerations for you.
Lori, mm-hmm. Before you continue, going back to data practices, mm-hmm. I apologize for interrupting. Does the data practices also give a notice when someone requests the data of a public member? does the public member get a notice when a request is made?
Oh, Mr. Chair, member, that is a really good question. There is no requirement when a public data request is made for data about you. There isn't a requirement that the government tell you about it. I have certainly, I was at the Department of Public Safety before coming to admin, and when we would get a data request for your personnel file, I find it really helpful to tell the employee or the member, we've gotten a request for your data, and we're only providing public data. I think it avoids many of the things when you get a call later about, hey, you're releasing my data and it's not appropriate. It's very important, I think, to do some of that proactive work so that people understand, I've gotten this. I'm only giving out what I'm allowed to give out, and you kind of have that heads up. Not required, but I think it would be certainly a really good best practice.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So as I talked about, it's really important that citizens can trust their government. And the open meeting law really is allowing the public to attend your meetings so that they can really understand the work that you're doing. In case law, there is a quorum rule. So I think Greg mentioned that there are 12 members of you. So a quorum is one more than half. And so there are two parts of this quorum rule. It is a majority of the full body or any quorum of your committees or subcommittees. And I don't know if you really actually have any of those. No. And the quorum is discussing, deciding, or receiving information as a group related to their official activities. So when there are seven of you gathered and you start talking about the business of this council, that's when you have to, you know, kind of have that trigger in your mind of a quorum. Perhaps this is a meeting. Perhaps this is one that we should notice. So just having, you know, seven of you gathered. As I mentioned, it's really a notice statute. So we've got regular meetings like this, and this is your first meeting, and I expect that you have or are going to decide on what is your the rest of your schedule going to look like. And if you stick to that regular schedule, and Greg and Sally have it on file at their office, there is no other notice requirements that you have to do. We know that the council, much like many other groups, is going to go above and beyond on their regular schedule, and you're going to have it on your website, and you're going to notify people. The actual requirement is just like one piece of paper that says we meet on the first Monday of every month. You might also, if the snow doesn't stop, you might have to have some special meetings where your regular meeting is going to be at a different time. And so that's when you need a three-day advanced posting on your website that includes, yep, we got snowed out, and here's when our next meeting is going to be. And emergency meetings are really meant, it's really what it sounds like. You have a natural disaster, this building is flooded, you need to have a build, you know, you need to have a meeting so that you can authorize someone to come in and fix it. That would be when you would do an emergency meeting notice, which is you can't do the regular one and you make a good faith effort to notify the media. So there are meetings that are not going to be covered by the law. Ones where you have only six of you, so less than a quorum. As I mentioned, you're probably all very good volunteers, and Minnesota and St. Paul, really pretty small world, you're going to run into each other. You're going to have those chance gatherings. You're going to go to the same retirement parties or the same banquets. Those are not subject to the law. You can also go to trainings together as a group, and that is, you know, you can't have discussion of official business. One of the things, we have an advisory opinion that said a public body, in this case it was a school board, could meet where the public was not there so that they could have facilitated discussion around that was like kind of team building. So those are fine as well, but you just can't be talking about business. Some of the special considerations, I think, in this electronic world, there is, I think, a greater tie between data practices and open meeting law. Sometimes members of the public might think that their members were having offline conversations, and they used to do it by phone or in person because maybe the discussion here wasn't as robust as they had hoped for. Now people are texting each other and emailing each other, and there would be documentation that you were, in fact, violating the open meeting law by having discussions you should be having in public. So we have an advisory opinion that's 10 years old, but it's still really good. and this public body, they weren't together, and it was still considered a meeting because they were all chiming in on a draft press release and saying, yep, you know, they suggested edits. They all kind of voted in favor of issuing the press release, and that was work that should have happened in a meeting. Also be aware that the courts have said that meetings, even when it is only six of you, or two of you, or three of you, can still violate the law if it's really done in a fashion to avoid public meetings. So you're trying to do vote count. You're trying to really, you know, kind of shuttle, how am I going to get the votes to pass something? And that could be a violation as well. So just be aware that you really need to, as best you can, have all of your conversations here. And I know that you will, with all the help that you've got here. The law also requires certain meetings to be closed, and if they are required or permitted by the law, all of those meetings, in addition to these, closed meetings get recorded as well, unless you are receiving attorney-client privileged information. Given the nature of your work, it's probably really important that you understand that there is not a general exception for when you talk about personnel or employment matters. Many people, it feels, especially for Minnesotans, it feels uncomfortable to sometimes have those conversations in an open forum, but that's, in fact, what the law requires. There's not just, we're going to talk about personnel, you can close all meetings. You are, of course, allowed to and have a choice about closing some meetings on different topics, especially as it relates to any attorney advice that you are receiving. Our law also adapts for the fact, and I think Greg already mentioned this, that you are allowed to have meetings by telephone or other electronic means. You could have a Skype meeting. There are rules around that, of course. The law was also updated recently to talk about kind of what about when public bodies and public members have social media. And you're still allowed to do that, but all the exchanges have to be public, so you can't screen somebody out. And it also excludes email. There are, of course, just like data practices, there are penalties and remedies if you violate the law, so that we all know it's super important. You also would have, if you had an intentional violation, are subject to a personal liability of a $300 fine. And if you did it three separate times, you could forfeit your office. One of the things we often hear from citizens that they're very unhappy about is if you were to violate the law and you made a decision, the law does not require that the decision you made is overturned if the meeting you had violated the open meeting law. Citizens think that's really unfair, and I've certainly seen government bodies go above and beyond, and if they find out, oh no, we didn't have the notice up there for 3 days, we made a decision, often they will then, even though they don't have to, at a subsequent meeting kind of reapprove whatever action they took. So that is something to keep in mind. As I mentioned, you're in a unique spot because you're both going to be following the open meeting law as well as data practices. You are allowed to talk about not public data in an open meeting if it's within the scope of your authority and it's reasonably necessary to do your work. So if this was a group that was going to be looking at grant proposals and you needed to all, you would have all the grant proposals and you need to have a discussion and pick one, you can do that, even though those proposals were not public at that time. You'd be saying, I like proposal A because of this. You like proposal B because of whatever that is. And the recording of that meeting would be public, but those grant proposals might still be protected by the Data Practices Act. It gets a little complicated, but you can do that. So don't think just because something is not public, you can't talk about it here. Just it needs to keep it within the realm of the work that you're doing. And then recordings are going to be are public as well, except for any not public data that's in that recording of a closed meeting. Coverage of these two laws. Are there questions folks have about this or something that I missed, Gail? Yes.
Could you talk about record retention? So the little post-it note, do we have a record retention policy that requires us to maintain that post-it note?
That is a great question, Gail. So DAT practices covers, all the post-it notes and all the things you write down. The Official Records Act is like that little thing. the official records, so the minutes for this meeting, the agenda, your final recommendations. You might have a lot of other working papers or notes that are subject to a data request, but are not your official records that need to be kept according to the schedule that you have for a certain period of time. So you would get guidance from the staff around what is the retention schedule, what is the information they need to collect from any of you before your work is done so that they can make sure to maintain it for the right amount of time. And records retention is also just sets the floor, like I have to keep something for at least a year, and it doesn't actually proactively tell you you can't keep it longer. So just be aware of that. And I'm not sure the retention schedule around some of the work of this group.
Mr. Chair, Gail, we need to check about what you would need to retain as members. We'll look into that and get back to
you. Yeah. And I always think it's my experience is that you should really collect the information while people are still working, because when you get a data request that for data that a vendor has and they're not your vendor anymore or they're not your elected official anymore, it's sometimes more challenging for government to get the data they need to be able to give to the citizen. So that would be my tip of the day.
The other tip I'd add to that is be careful what you write if in fact, you're going to maintain that written note.
Right. And one of the things, too, while you don't have to keep your notes, if someone makes a data request for them, you can't start disposing of them after someone has made a request. But know that, you know, going along, you don't have to keep your drafts, you know, kind of just mechanically. Make sure you keep yourself as lean as possible. It makes responding to data requests more easy to do. So we always encourage folks to really figure out what's the data they need to keep and have to keep and trying to work within that.
Any more?
No, I really wish you all the best of work. The role of this council is really important for the state, and I am really thankful to be able to have given you some information, and I wish you the best of luck with your work.
We thank you very much for that. In fact, I'd like you to just, in part because I may be from the generation that's not too swift on some of the social media things here, but my experience in my law practice has been that repeatedly people get into trouble about emails, texting, and I guess tweeting now, and everything from, well, we know about tweeting. And just run over that again. So if we start emails going back and forth, what are the requirements and what are not, or texting or whatever?
So, Mr. Chair and members, your conversation, so if you are emailing back and forth, you want to make sure that you are trying to avoid the reply all so that you are not having more than a quorum of you kind of on an email chain where you are discussing the substance of the work of this council. Those are conversations you should have here. It is totally appropriate for like kind of one-way communication where you all say, I'd like to share this article with you because I think it's useful for our future meeting, or you'll get emails in advance from the staff. All of that is totally appropriate. Just remember, you know, trying to avoid reply all and having discussions about the merits of your work, that's where I think the real line is. The advisory opinion we had, this group really was doing the work via email of their council, and it should have happened in an open meeting. Or you decide, if you want to do a press release, you enable your chair to be able to have the power to do that on your behalf. So making some decisions about that might be helpful and helps you stay within the bounds of the law. As to social media, if you are on Twitter or Facebook and you have kind of a Facebook page for this group, you can't screen anyone. So everything on your Facebook page would need to be kind of open so that members of the public could see who was saying what and what you were saying. I always hate to admit this, I'm not on social media at all either, so I'm not an expert in that either. But you're right. The more things people write down that are out there, it reflects on you and it'll reflect on the work here. So being cautious about that, and I would recommend that.
Thank you. That's very helpful, and I would add about the caution of that, because I have seen repeatedly in a variety of contexts, and I think all the lawyers, I see there's a bunch of lawyers in the group here, have probably come across similar problems of come from that, that things look a little different in hindsight when they come out or one thing or another. So be cautious, I guess. I guess sound advice. Thank you very much. That was a very good presentation.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I was gonna, my one final thought for you is I was realizing, too, is I will tell someone, I'm like, oh, I talked to someone today. And actually, I was texting with them or emailing with them, and to me, it was like a conversation. So just remembering that we've gotten to this habit where our devices are an extension of us. So thank you again.
Good. Thank you very much. Very helpful.
Mr. Chair?
Great.
Members, we have two tasks ahead of us based on what Lori just told us about needing to adopt policies related to these two laws. They're in your packets. The first one is the Comp Council Data Practices Policy for Members of the Public. And both of these were posted on the webpage a couple of days ago, so hopefully you've had a chance to look at it. But basically, this is a general policy indicating to the public about how they access documents of the council. It describes the process. This is the same policy that you adopted 2 years ago. It again assigns the responsibility for implementing this to the staff.
So we should adopt this policy?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I'll make that motion to adopt.
We have a motion to adopt the compensation policy, data policy that's in your packet. Discussion?
There are two policies.
Gail? We'll take them one at a time. We'll take them one at a time. The first one is the data practices policy for members of the public.
Second.
So that's before you. Now we have a motion and second. Any discussion? If not, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carried. The second policy.
So moved.
Mr. Chair, yes, this is the data practices policy for data subjects. This is the policy that applies to you and how members of the public can access information about you. As Lori mentioned, we've got public data on you, your names, addresses, that sort of thing. We also have some private information, your Social Security number, so that we can reimburse you for your expenses. That is not public. This policy lays that out and describes how people can access that, and it's the same policy that you adopted 2 years ago.
Gail, motion to approve. Second.
There's a second. But there's also discussion.
Discussion.
Yep. So my question is, I'd like to see if we can amend the policy to add in that if the request for data is made for a member of the committee or the council, that a notice be given to that member. And I want to see if that's appropriate and what the rest of the council's feedback is on that. So if a member of the public asks for Jennifer's information, she should at least get notice that a request is made, as an example.
I personally would not like to see that adopted. I would like the staff to do that voluntarily, but not to make it a requirement, just adding something that is not common in government, as far as I know, in terms of a required act. But I think it is, I agree with Lori, it's a nice practice. It gives the other person a heads up. Relevant to this question, Greg, how many requests for information were received about council data? Were there any requests for information on the council members?
Gail, not any information requested on members. We get many requests for data that the council used, that sort of thing.
Okay.
And our practice would be, as Jim suggests, to inform a member if there's a request on them. Just point out that a member of the public requesting data doesn't have to identify themselves, so you may not know who it is that's requesting it.
The reason that they're asking.
Or the reason, exactly.
Right. And I think those are very important points, Gail. I wouldn't want to stop anyone from the public. I'd want them to know, even anonymously. I would just want to know. I don't know if any of the other members would know that there has been a request to make, because we would want to also communicate with staff to make sure they have everything they need. So if we had an outdated address, maybe we've moved from one apartment to the next or something, but they might need that updated data, even though it's our responsibility to update it. That idea of having the staff contact them to say, hey, there's been a data request, you then know to make sure they have all the current data. So there's
that. But the responsibility for the government entity is to respond with what data it has, not to try to update it or to try to supplement or whatever. So I would prefer not to see it as a requirement, but rather as a practice.
Jim?
My particular concern, Mr. Rollins, is that in these last two cycles, we now have...
Can you speak up a little bit more, please?
We have two groups, the legislative and our own, under a truncated process that ends at the end of this month. And I just think staff, because this is a very busy time for this commission staff, and knowing that they're very experienced and would tend to, if they're concerned about that kind of a request, that they would inform sort of by their own judgment if they're concerned that it's an invasive request. But I think it's make work to make it in the policy. So that's just my feeling about it.
And other discussion about it or any motions? If not, the policy is before you, and we have a motion to approve the policy? I guess that's before us right now. This was part of the discussion. If no further discussion, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carried. That was actually an interesting point. Glad you raised that. Okay, then are we going to move on to duties? Duties of the Compensation Council, what we are all about here. Welcome.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Stephanie James. I'm one of the lawyers employed by the Senate. We are an office of nonpartisan lawyers and fiscal analysts that serve all of the senators. We have counterparts in the House that do the same thing, and we help out with tasks that the LCC, the Legislative Coordinating Commission, is doing. So I'm here to perform that function for you. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about your duties. There's a memo in your packet from Stephanie James that describes your duties. I'll just walk through it. The state constitution provides for the salaries of judges and constitutional officers to be set by law. And by law, it means a bill passed by both bodies of the legislature in the same form and signed by the governor. And the constitutional officers are the governor, the lieutenant governor, the secretary of state, the state auditor, and the attorney general. To assist the legislature in setting those salaries by law, this compensation council was established in 1983. And then by statute, in addition to the duties to set salaries for constitutional officers and judges, you were also given the task to set salaries for state agency heads and for the head of the Metropolitan Airports Commission. For the agency heads, you'll set a maximum for a salary range, and that has to be expressed as a percentage of the governor's salary. And the governor's salary currently is $127,629 for a year. The recommendations of this council don't take effect until for judges and constitutional officers won't take effect until the first Monday in January of the next odd-numbered year. So that means that your recommendations for judges and constitutional officers will be for January of 2021. The recommendations that you make for agency heads, however, will take effect retroactively to January 1st, 2019. The legislature has the authority, of course, to pass whatever laws it wishes, and so the effect of that is that it may adopt your recommendations into law, or it might not. The council has several statutorily required considerations for you in making your recommendations. First, you need to consider the amount of compensation paid in government service and the private sector to people with similar qualifications. You need to consider the amount needed to attract and retain experienced and competent persons. And you have to consider the ability of the state to pay the recommended levels. Once your recommendations are complete, the council ceases to exist. That is my presentation. Any questions on that?
Questions about our duties and obligations and whatever? David.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about something you said. You said our recommendations take effect on January 2021, but that assumes the legislature adopts them, correct? They don't take effect automatically.
Mr. Chair and members, yes, that is correct. These would be the your recommendations will be for these to take effect on those dates. But absolutely, the legislature could make them effective immediately or in 2023 or not at all. Yes.
Mr. Chairman. One question. Timeline for our current duties and when are they due?
Mr. Chair and members, you are required to complete your work by April 1st.
That's one thing we will be discussing a little later on here, what our schedule will be to meet that recommendation by April 1st. I have a question for you because I served on the council last time around, and we made several recommendations to the legislature and about when they should go into effect and made some changes. Based on your experience, and this might be a difficult question for you, but do they pay any attention to that, and how do we go about trying to make them pay some attention to that? And I understand that may be difficult for you to answer, but I'm going to ask the question anyways.
Mr. Chair and members, to the extent that the council wants to make recommendations beyond your statutorily required duties, you're free to do that. They have no official weight, but they carry the weight of the fact that the group has deliberated on these things and have suggestions. I do believe that members, legislative members, would be interested in what you have to say about changes to your statutes that you think would be a good idea. The task with getting the attention of any legislator is to have meetings with them, to present to them your ideas, to find in the legislature advocates who would work to make your suggestions happen.
And should we decide to go down that path, you see nothing inappropriate about doing that or pushing the envelope a little bit about some things that we decide to do?
Mr. Chair and members, no, there's nothing that says that you are not permitted to make recommendations beyond your statutorily required recommendations. So you should, I believe, feel free to approach members.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
One additional question for the ability of the members of the council before April 1st and after April 1st. Are we allowed or restricted in testifying before State Assembly or Senate committees?
Mr. Chair and members, no, there's no restriction on that activity. I think it would be important to be clear about whether or not you're speaking on behalf of the group or on for your own, to offer your own observations.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, okay. I'd point out that the council dissolves on April 1st, and so if you wanted to continue pursuing informing the legislature about your recommendations, you would have to do that as individuals, and you wouldn't be able to have meetings.
Well, we kind of go poof.
You wouldn't be able to have authorized meetings, but you wouldn't be precluded from having meetings after April 1st, since this would no longer be a body.
Right.
All right. Thank you very much. That was very helpful. And now, I think we'll vary from the agenda here if we can, because we have some guests who want to testify and present some testimony for us. And the items 6, 7, and 8 on our agenda are things we can deal with internally. And I think it might be good to move ahead and get, as a courtesy to these people who are taking their time to come and testify and explain some things here. And the first one, I guess, is from the Office of the Attorney General. If we can start there, Richard Allen.
Yes, Chairman Berg.
Hello again.
Hello again.
And welcome to our group, and we look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members, and thank you for all of you folks that are willing to step up and do this kind of tough job. I am here because I have some history in the past with the Attorney General's office. I was able to serve under two Attorney Generals in years past, Warren Spanis and Hubert H. Humphrey III. And in those days, I managed the criminal division for a while. I was the Solicitor General for a while, and I was the Chief Deputy Attorney General at the conclusion of Attorney General Spanis's term, and I was fortunate enough to serve Skip Humphrey. So I served through a transition. And you should know that I am currently a non-compensated special attorney for the current Attorney General, Keith Ellison, to help him with the transition in assuming office. I am a partner in a Minneapolis law firm. Well, it's a national law firm with a headquarters mostly in Minneapolis, Robbins Kaplan. And Robbins Kaplan's not the biggest firm in town, but it's a pretty good size, 250 lawyers. It's had some fame with the state, as we were the firm that represented the state of Minnesota in the tobacco litigation. I have, in my years with Robbins, been chairman of the hiring committee. I've been part of the process of setting compensation for lawyers and legal assistants. And was also chair of the recruiting committee for a few years. And so I'm here today to speak on behalf of the compensation for the constitutional officer, office of attorney general. As you recall, the AG's pay is 95% of what the governor's pay is. And right now, Attorney General Ellison's comp is $121,248. That compensation hasn't been substantially increased. For many years, there were small increases in back in the, I think, 15 and 16, but there was a gap of 12 years where there was no raises, and there's no current COLA increase in place. There's no inflation protection in place for any of the constitutional officers, including Mr. Ellison. No one forced Mr. Ellison to come and serve here. He made $174,000 a year as a congressman. But I would like to advocate that, as with the other constitutional officers, that pay for this position is way too low to embrace and encourage people to step up and serve, in this case, as the state's chief legal officer. Isn't that the chief law enforcement officer, like was bandying about the last election? But he's the chief legal officer. And the AG's office serves over 100 state agencies, boards, and commissions, 7,000 open legal files a year. The size and complexity of litigation that you encounter in this particular office on behalf of this state, particularly the executive branch, is enormous, and it's a wonderful place to be if you want to serve in the public. It really is. But the AG needs to be a strong and capable leader. The cases that the Attorney General's office under the AG leadership, be it Lori Swanson or Keith Ellison, are huge for state interests. If the legislature passes a statute, they want it upheld when it's challenged in court. It doesn't matter if it's Republican or Democrat. It's the laws of the state and the constitutionality of the state that need to be upheld. The AG's office is involved in numerous cases that recover money for the state, millions of dollars. The AG's office involved in protecting the assets of the state. There's a recent tax case involving some corporate interests trying to recover $700 million of state monies that the AG was able to defeat. So many of you know this office very well, and I'm perhaps preaching to the choir, but what's important is to recognize this is the leader of a major, very important law office of some considerable size, 135 lawyers, 350 employees. It would be a major size law firm in comparison in the Twin Cities.
Mr. Allen, let me just interrupt for one second here. there are a number of us who are attorneys on the the council here, but there's also a number of people that are not and are new to this, and I think this is a very legitimate topic. We'll be getting into this with the constitutional officers at some detail later on, so I think it's very much in order for you to explain the duties and things as you go forward here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen. So the Attorney General supervises a number of divisions that are devoted to specialty areas. It might be the state college system in Minsk, the DNR. It's the DNR is a great example. There's enormous amount of litigation that comes out of there, and it involves issues beyond hunting and fishing and Indian law and natural resources and mining and the like. And it's the lawyers at the AG's office, by law, are the people that go into court. There's a purpose for the AG being the exclusive lawyers for doing that, and that is to have continuity and clarity and consistency in the application of the laws as they're presented in court, so that when you're up in Kitson County, you're taking the same position as you were in Cook County or in Wantwan County or in Hennepin County. So there's skill in management, there's skill in legal experience that is brought to bear to try and ensure this the public's lawyer and the public laws are uniformly being defended. Mr. Robbins.
Mr. Robbins has a question for you, I think.
I'm not an attorney. I'm curious, what impact does the Attorney General's actual salary have on staff salaries? What's the situation with retention of senior staff? Is there an issue with bumping up, and are there losses to other public legal entities such as the major counties, that sort of thing?
It's a great question, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Robbins, the constitutional officer salaries are basically march along with the governor's salary. And it's treated separately. And each agency, including the AG, has to develop a compensation plan for the various levels of professionals that are in the office. Of course, secretaries are part of the state unions and so on. That's done separately. So the deputies and assistant attorney general's compensation has to be reviewed and approved really by office management budget and has to be appropriated by the legislature. It is not locked to the AG's salary, but certainly his and her lower salary unfortunately is reflected up and down the line with the compensation levels that are here. The AG's office tries to retain people that have developed skills, and the truth of the matter is, because comp is low, people leave and go to firms throughout the state and downtown St. Paul, Minneapolis. So the AG's salary is important as a marker for the rest of the compensation, but it isn't locked to it the way it is with the governor. I'm not sure I answered all your questions, but
Mr. Allen, are there any assistants or deputies or people in the office that make more money than the Attorney General for that reason?
So the answer is, Mr. Chairman, yes, there are. The four deputies and the Solicitor General, according to the compensation plan approved by MMB and submitted by the AG's office, make in a neighborhood that senior management will be between about $139,000 and $154,000, I think, is the max. Nobody makes any more than that in the office. And when we get a chance, I'd like to compare that for you with what's going on downtown, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and some other cities of Minnesota. The way the compensation is figured out here for these lawyers, folks, is there's three levels of pay for assistant attorney generals. And then there's a management category for the people that are overall coordinating and supervising divisions of lawyers. And so the deputies, four deputies, a solicitor, think of the solicitor as like a deputy, would be in that management category. There are some people who are division leaders below them. They're assistant attorney generals, but they're leaders. They got managed resources. But a very typical salary range is $80,000, $75,000 for the lawyers doing the work of the state. You know, there's no question people do it in part because they want to serve the public and it feels good. I know I've done it myself for 12 years.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question.
Mr. Wenzel.
Yep. Mr. Allen, you're a well-regarded and well-respected gentleman by the legal community around this table. I am a civilian from the southern part of the state, and I'd like your assistance in answering one of the questions. The council is instructed under statute to consider three items. One of them is the amount of compensation, and I'm amending it. The second one is the amount needed to attract and retain experienced and competent persons. And third, the ability of the state to pay. I'm concerned with number two. As you understand, in your earlier testimony, you said that no one had forced Mr. Ellison to run for office. He volunteered. And it was also your testimony that he had taken possibly a step down from being a congressperson to the attorney general. As I understand it, there was a full primary on both sides of the political spectrum, so there were volunteers and talent that the public had to choose from. Could you address how you believe compensation would either make the talent pool better for the public or not better for the public, or how it may affect it? If I'm looking at just that one of the two statutory items, I'm concerned that not necessarily the pay needs to be adjusted because there is a large talent of individuals on the conservative, on the DFL side, et cetera, that are interested in the AG's position. So I'd like your feedback on that to assist me in my process.
Mr. Allen.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Wenzler, great question, I think. The one way to look at this is what is the position and who do you want to attract and what's the pool of people you want to attract from? Compensation, and that helps me. Let me transition to in the handout to part five, and just give you an example of why I think it's important to raise the pay of your constitutional officers, particularly the attorney general. One, you'd want and encourage the attorney general, hopefully, to be fully enthusiastic, fully engaged, and if the stars align themselves, run for office again rather than having to go into private practice. Right now, according to the National Association of Legal Placement Directors, there's Exhibit 2 to my report. You'll see the 23 largest firms in Minnesota are listed. And it shows what they pay entry-level lawyers. So when you think about what this pay level is for a current leader of the state's law office, the starting pay averages $140,000. That's for a first-year, right out of law school lawyer. People who have clerked for Supreme Court and other places can actually get more. It's a lot of money, I'm certain, but it's reflective of the market for good lawyers. And that's just that's the starting pay. The average pay in the larger firms and the AG's office is definitely up in that category. After 2 or 3 years, is $150,000 a year, the amount that you recommended for the governor 2 years ago. Compensation has got to be an element for asking people to serve in the public sector. What's been recommended in the past is certainly not intended to be matching up with what the managing partners that the major law firms in the Twin Cities would make, which should, I can tell you what I know. It's certainly between $500,000 and $1 million a year, and it's a ton of dough. Nobody's asking that for the Attorney General. But I think what compensation is one of those factors, along with wanting to serve, that's going to encourage you to have the best possible pool of people running for these offices. Why is it important? Because they're managing your assets. They are taking care of your property. They're protecting the taxpayer.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Allen, over time, has the Attorney General and his office lost, relatively speaking, to the salaries in the private sector?
Yes, it's slow. It's been falling farther and farther behind.
And what have those effects been?
Well, there is more turnover than I think that you would want for your lawyers to represent you in the specialty areas, be it Indian law, be it tax law, whatever it is. And so it's unfortunate, but there's about a 15% turnover now, and that's on an annual basis. It's not what I'd want, and it's not what I'd want for the state, because you're losing out on experience, you're losing out on people that understand issues better. But, you know, there's a market for litigators. Mr. Chairman knows better than I do. There's a big market for specialists, be in tax law or any number of other things. And it's the way it's always going to be, but we'd like to be able to be within, you know, some distance.
I also understand that there has been, and I don't know if this is still the case, but there has been a glut of attorneys. Is that still in play?
You know, after 2008, it's true. It became a buyer's market for a few years as our economies recovered, especially Minnesota. It's flipped around again. And the job market is pretty good for qualified lawyers coming out of the three law schools that are here and who come in from the law schools in Wisconsin and Iowa and the Dakotas. So the glut has changed. And then secondly, you want to be able to recruit people that are well qualified. And some people are better qualified than others. So compensation is one of the elements of
Mr. Robbins, and then Mr. Asp.
I apologize. I'm going to have to leave right after this. Mr. Allen, this is James Robbins. Maybe you addressed this, but I'm particularly concerned with loss of AG attorneys to other public entities, whether it be the major counties, city, those sort of litigator folks.
And I didn't really address it very well. You're right, Mr. Chairman. On the handout, I hope, I'm sorry I didn't have it to you last night to be with your material. Apologize for that. But you'll notice the head of the Hennepin County Attorney's Office makes $177,000 a year. Ramsey County, Stearns County, Dakota County, all these people are making far more than what's even been projected for the governor. The University of Minnesota General Counsel makes $350,000 a year. The pay scale in Hennepin County is better by a long shot than it is here. The pay scale for the U.S. Attorney's Office in Minneapolis, and it's on here, Mr. Robbins, on the bottom of the first page. Assistant U.S. attorneys make anywhere from about $140,000 to $160,000, and the U.S. attorney makes $160,000. So there is a loss from people who want to work in the public sector into these jobs. You're right on about that. It's they get trained here, and then they get to get better jobs there. And you can want to serve the public as much as possible, but if you're putting kids through school, that pay downtown sounds pretty good.
Mr. Asp.
Yeah, it's a very similar question from me. Is there anything when you talk about losing qualified lawyers from the Attorney General's office, especially to other public agencies, you're talking about the pay of assistant attorney generals or deputy assistant attorney generals, things like that. Is there anything now that, I don't think we recommend pay for those positions.
Right.
And couldn't the attorney general increase those salaries on his or her own?
Mr. Chairman, the way it works, he can't completely. And the way it works is this way. Each of these agencies, AG included, has to prepare a compensation plan. It's by statute. And it's submitted to MMB for purposes of coordination and comparison with the various agency heads and so on. In the end, though, the AG's budget controls the compensation, and it's up to the legislature to agree with that or not. The AG gets monies from the general fund primarily. Some money is billed to the agencies, and some money comes from the federal government for Medicaid fraud prosecutions that they do. So the AG is limited by the approval of MMB and of the legislature.
Mr. Evenson.
Quick question. I guess looking at this salary thing and being a lawyer, is this really representative, though, of all lawyers? I mean, there's different firms like my firm that are mid-size, and we're obviously not charging rates. I know the rates these firms charge are obviously that you're charging $400, $600, $800 to $1,000 an hour. We can then justify maybe pay like this. I mean, what are the rates for mid-sized firms and other firms when you're comparing them? Because to me, this isn't comparing apples to apples when I hear about what people are charging at other firms and the like.
Right.
Maybe the public officers are a better comparison then, because the Attorney General's office does similar work in some respects to those public offices, and yet they're all paid much higher.
Yeah, that seems more comparable than comparing it to like a Jones Day or something.
I think it's just representative of the market. Do you have mid-size numbers you'd want to bring in?
I don't think a lot of them actually give. I think the larger ones actually give them because people want to see this number. Right. Yeah. But in reality, I think a lot of lawyers end up at mid-size or smaller. And I've served on the MSBA, and you heard about people sleeping in their cars working up north, making $50,000 or less, and it didn't make any sense for them to go to law school. So I think comparing them on Exhibit 2 isn't, to me, make any sense. I think comparing them to the salaries of maybe the other county attorneys and the U.S. Attorney's Office seems more.
I think this is a helpful discussion. Let it keep going. But I wonder, at some point, Mr. Allen, would you be willing to come back if we get into this a little bit later on? Because we're going to hear from the district judges here in a while. And we can keep going for a while here, but I just wanted to, because we're really getting into the meat of it now, and it's an excellent discussion by the council members here, too. So, Ms. Olson, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, I was just suggesting that that this helps give a picture of what the competition is for. Obviously, everybody isn't in a large firm. I understand that. But nevertheless, it shows a range in who we may be competing against for positions.
Mr. Chairman, if I could go after Joy.
Mr. Wenzler.
Joy, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I am also not an attorney, do not work in the legal field. My citizen knowledge, though, is that many past AGs have gone into private practice, or that there is a competitive career path for them in private practice. Could you speak to kind of what the career path and earning potential after the service as the AG would be?
Well, it's certainly true that lawyers have gone on from the AG's office to have had reasonably good careers. I don't want to say it. I'm thinking about myself right now, but the AG's office was a wonderful, wonderful experience, and it certainly helped me be a better lawyer in the private sector. I think it's true that for some people who worked there for a time and developed a skill, that they've certainly gone out into private firms, big and small,
and as well as governmental bodies, and typically are going to be compensated much better. The one comment I'd like to just make to you, I use the 23 biggest law firms as a comparison because the AG's office is one of the biggest law offices in the state. It's not a small firm. But I agree with you that if you took all the lawyers in the state at their compensation level, it's closer to the study that the court folks have got handed to you, and it shows midpoint, high point, and so on. And they are smaller than the biggest firm. One reason we look at the big public law offices and the big private firms is the AG's is a big office, and it's got huge responsibilities. Think of the state's budget, and what you're trying to do is defend the actions of the legislature and the like. So the responsibility level there is more than a small law firm. It's not putting it down. It's just that you want to attract by compensation people who've got the education and the skill and the interest to serve your interest. And that's why I'm harping on this.
Can I respond to Joy before we go?
Ms. Olson.
I'm sorry. Yes. So just looking back at Attorneys General, I don't know if Lori Swanson has returned to private practice. I expect that she would. That's where she came from. Skip Humphrey, after his tenure, went into other public positions and public service positions. Warren Spanis did join a law firm. That was 30-plus years ago. I don't know that there's a big pattern of people who weren't already in private practice, you know, coming in to be Attorney General and then jumping into some big other position.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Wensler.
I want to thank Mr. Allen for coming today. On behalf of the council members and the chair, your testimony has been enlightening for me. I have one follow-up question. You had made a comment in your testimony that there seems to be a rotation of attorneys generals where they may not stay, and you had attached that to compensation. Why do you believe an attorney general may or may not stay based on compensation if the attorney general ran for the position, not necessarily because of compensation? Please.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's because there's personal challenges in their life. Children having to go off to college. They've got sick family members. I'm not going to comment on Attorney General Ellison's situation, but I can summarize by saying, no, he's got obligations beyond he and his wife. So I think people do encounter circumstances where they say, I can't continue to afford it at this level. And I've seen that and heard it in other places. And,
thank you.
Politics being what it is, I don't know.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Allen, I'm trying to sort between the question of fairness and the question of what we need to attract good public servants. And from what you were saying earlier, it sounds like the staff of the Attorney General's office is not directly related to the compensation of the Attorney General. And so I'm thinking maybe we're more concerned about the staff compensation because they have institutional memory, and certainly we want people to stay in there because to train new people is costly, and new people are going to make mistakes, and generally speaking, the people with experience should be more capable of litigating or whatever the Attorney General has to do. So could you please help clarify that distinction on the one hand between fairness and necessity, and on the other hand between the Attorney General's compensation and the staff compensation? I'm more interested in the staff compensation, I think, as Mr. Wensler was suggesting, because the motivation of the Attorney General would be different from that of the staff.
Mr. Allen.
Geez, that's a tough question.
Two questions.
Those are great questions.
They're great questions.
Yeah, we try to specialize in tough questions.
Yeah, I think they're related, albeit the compensation of the staff is regulated in a somewhat different and more similar pattern to the state agencies, generally the commissions alike. But the Attorney General's compensation is just one element, certainly, as it would be for anybody, of why they do a job. And I think you want to have a sense of fairness that what you're doing is of value to the state, is of value to the citizens. Secondly, I want the Attorney General to be compensated at a level that reflects to his staff that he is valued and is an important figure in the state, so that the gap between their compensation and the Attorney General's isn't so wide. Certainly, the compensation for the staff is an important issue, and I don't pretend to be here today to be talking to you about that, other than I think it's too low. But I think pay is part of what helps people be able to do jobs or to keep the job after they get there. I've seen it my own life. I've seen it my whole life, and I'm ancient, 76 years old. So we want government to work, and I think you got to help. I hate to say it this way, but you got to pay for it, just like people do in private sector, and not use low compensation as a way to inhibit government doing the job. Sorry, that's my little speech. My last point, Mr. Chairman, is we asked for the Attorney General to at least, I hope you'll at least renew the recommendation you made in 2017, or as an alternative, we suggested 6% a year just to start to get some catch-up for the AG. And hopefully that doesn't seem too aggressive or asking for too much, but certainly that study you did last time was, many, many people thought it was very well done and was well received, and I appreciate very much you let me come.
Well, thank you. We appreciate your coming here. This has been a wonderful discussion, I think, for the committee members for our first meeting. We're kind of getting organized here, and we would get right into the meat and potatoes of things, and your presentation was excellent on that, and the response of council members, I think, was very good. We will continue this, and it may be, if you're willing, Mr. Allen, we conceivably would ask you to come back sometime if you're willing to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, and I thank committee members. I think this was our council member. This was a wonderful beginning. Let's take a 10-minute break and come back and hear from the District Judges Association.